health-wise, to come back to that, in a city or in the countryside, to be able to live independently or autonomously for as long as possible, that is truly, in my opinion, and I think shared with many others, a really healthy way to continue to live.
Hello and welcome to episode 41 of What Buildings Do, a podcast about the lives we all live in the company of buildings and the built environment. This is the first of three episodes made in response to a project called Reimagining Elderhood. Initiated by a group called SOA, SOA, or Self-Organized Architecture, Reimagining Elderhood is an architecture-led project that explores the future of housing needs of people in midlife in Ireland. Truth is, we are all getting older, there's no avoiding it, but ageing and housing in Ireland tend to conjure up all kinds of not-so-happy images and, unfortunately, it is really hard to shake off the prospect of a nursing home waiting for us at the end of the road as we get older and might need just a little more support. But what are the other options available? How might we age better in place, and what kind of housing do we need that allows us to live together in elderhood in a supported and supportive built environment? These questions and many more will come up in this episode and in this series of podcasts. The Reimagining Elderhood project had an open call run by SOA, and out of this, three architects were selected and paired with three mentors. The idea is that the architects selected would get advice, support, and, well, mentoring from another architect who had more experience in housing, working on designs for elderhood, or working with specific communities of interest. A critical part of this project, you see, on Reimagining Elderhood, was to invite the architects to work with specific groups or community groups of interest, to include them and collaborate with them, to consider the questions together, to draw on their lived experience and their imaginations to reimagine their world now and into their future. First up in this episode is Alva Cunningham, an architect based in Cork, who worked out of a record shop with a community group of musicians, collectors and more. Alva was mentored by Inka Drone, an architect based in Germany who specialises in cooperative and self-organised housing projects. This is a fascinating conversation, which throws up so many issues we face in housing generally. Access, security of tenure, and ability to be private and public. And it also reminds us that it is possible to consider building housing for centuries and not just for now and for the speed-driven property market. To begin the conversation, I started by asking Alva to tell us why she had responded to this intriguing call about elderhood by SOA.
SOA's open call, it really chimed in many different ways with me. It felt timely to be considering issues local to Cork City, issues that were relevant not only to people today, and I felt all of us kind of in our 30s, 40s, 50s, right through into elderhood. Really interesting as well to consider preparing, very proactively preparing for something that we very desperately see in the newspapers being, you know, it's not going to be a surprise. There's going to be a bulge in the aging population. As a country, how are we preparing for that? Is there any preparation for that? It's something that statistically, you know, is set in stone from the day that everyone is born, but really to take a proactive, hands-on, community-led approach to exploring it, that was the main draw for me.
And in your work before the call, what had you been doing that kind of prepared you a little bit for it?
Over the course of the last 3 years, I've been looking very closely at expanded architectural practice and very much transitioning, you could say, from traditional architecture practice to more blended methods. Some people often, months and months into knowing me, almost surprisingly, they discover that I'm an architect and they kind of question what I'm up to. So it's really looking at how our skill sets can be applied outside of the bricks and mortar delivery of architecture, and how we can start to interact with what exists, how we can start to understand how people perceive, experience, live within or live without architecture. And at the end of the day, always hoping to end up producing something, but really acknowledging and leaning heavily into the idea that architecture is something that is civic, it's urban or it's rural, you know, its scale is landscape, and that it is also something that is collaborative. Even if there is one sole author, listed at the end of a project. There is a list the length of your arm and longer of people who have encountered, interacted, contributed to projects. So really taking that as the starting point for practice and looking at how it applies. In my instance, I suppose I'm very interested in urban contexts, so how we become agents and how a city develops. And one ongoing project that I'm engaged with in Cork City is looking at how we can positively demonstrate how, you know, vacant or underused sites can be brought back to life. And that's not just for humans, but also non-human inhabitation. So really trying to live in the complexity of an urban context and then try and learn in situ, learn from it, learn with it, and grow new projects, new ideas, new things out of it.
And you explored some of those themes you just mentioned there about vacancy and let's say cohabitation of human and non-human life in the Tesside project.
Exactly. Yes. So Tesside project, that's really the launch pad of my formal explorations of expanded practice. So that began as a collaborative project in 2020 with an artist, Aoife Desmond, and a group of six of us initially came together and we started walking, you could really say rambling through the streets of Cork City. And we all somehow landed on this one place. We all had memories of it, but they were memories. None of us had active or present day associations with Curl's Quay, and realized very quickly between us that Curl's Quay had historically been a really significant bustling part of Cork City, but through vacancy and underuse had become forgotten. The quays either side of it, really well known across the river from it, all recognisable, really coming straight to the present mind for people. But Curl's Quay itself, through like significant numbers and layers of active use and change, had kind of just fallen by the wayside and was sitting there, you could say idle. And then when on closer inspection, you look at it actually just working to serve ecology and other forms and functions currently. So it's been a fascinating project to put forward a proposition to the city for people to come and collaborate together, and for people across all disciplines. So we have, it's a local authority owned site, so we have huge engagement across many of the departments within the local authority. We have community organizations that span across art, architecture, ecology, architectural historians involved, industrial historians, right down through the people who work on the street, back through to their childhoods, people who are resident in the local area. So it really is allowing everybody to come through the doors to engage in conversation, to engage in applied workshops, all sorts of activities, just to see what we can learn together and what we can develop and propose for the city.
Okay. Well, that already sounds, I mean, since 2020, there's been a lot of prep work that might have been relevant or useful for this call. So when you came to the call and responded to the call, did you already know how you're going to take on this theme of elderhood with regard to the city and what community you might decide to work with? Or how did that evolve? And is that, at what point did Inca come into that process with you?
So having worked in Cork City at that point for close on 3 years, and I suppose also living in the city, I had learned, or I suppose I'd gathered some clues as to how I might approach it. So one of the collaborators that we had come into contact with on Curl's Quay was Jimmy Horgan in Plugged Records, and the community of independent musicians who you could say fall in and out through the doors there as they come back from tours, or as they're local in Cork City, some living in Cork City, others traveling from around the country or from abroad to come back to share what they have developed or works in progress in within the record shop. So that, I suppose, it was definitely a community identified through the work of being situated on Curl's Quay for so long, that identified that neighbouring community on the Cold Quay that we would work with. Inca's involvement really, I suppose, came through the open call, and SOA paired us with our mentors. But what really quickly, I suppose, became apparent was that Inca's work, although you could say at the far side of Europe, very much resonated with what I was aspiring to do with a group of creatives. Inca had a project in Berlin, a project which is still in taking formation, working with artists and figuring out how artists can live and work into elderhood. So that immediately just showed complete resonance with what I was interested at looking at. Creative people who, in you know, they very industriously weave their way through precarity and work contracts and uncertain living working conditions the whole way through their young and middle age. I was fascinated then with how they might apply some of the things that they have learned, the way that they creatively weave their way through process, and how that could be applied to the built environment. And then Inka's experience of applying that, you know, with the creative person as her true client, on a real project in Germany, that was just fascinating straight away. That, I suppose, yeah, SOA had just paired us really well, I felt.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to unpack in that, I think. Particularly, I'm interested in when you talk about this community of creatives and this community of creative musicians who beautifully said about how they've fallen in and out of the doors of the local record store might have something to say, or very particular points of view, or very particular directions they want to pursue in this conversation about the future of the, let's say, housing or the built environment into elderhood, based on their own experience and trajectory in life. But maybe before we get there, it'll come up again, I'm sure, in this question with Inka, but why did you get involved in the project, and how did your relationship with SOA start? Was that a previous collaboration, or?
There was a previous collaboration. I think we share this interest. I love the name self-organized architecture, because I'm very much involved in Berlin is a scene of similar project, but self-organized means not self-organized by the architect. I think the name implies that self-organized architects, like architect assist groups that self-organize their housing and buildings, and therefore are very user need oriented projects. So it's more that architects turn toward very user friendly, user need oriented buildings and ways how to bring them into life. A little bit like an opposite of investment oriented buildings, which I think is the mainstream today. You know, the mainstream is architecture that takes just as much user friendliness into it that it can be sold. But the main issue seems to be, how can I improve the return of investment? While SOA and groups that I collaborate with, like Experiment Days in Berlin, and what we'll call, there's a Bündnis Junge Genossenschaften, BJ, which is like assembly of young cooperatives, like young founded cooperatives that design housing projects together with a group of people that are organized as cooperatives. So I'm in several of these organizations, and they very well, I like the word resonate, that resonates with what Zohar does. So I was invited by Zohar, I think it was 2019, to give a talk in Dublin on self-organized architecture in Berlin. And we got to know each other from there. And I was so happy when they called me and asked if I would join the Reimagine Elderhood. And I think one reason was that I did not only organize this project for artists in Berlin now who are thinking about elderhood, but we have a joint houses building group project finished already that was self-organized by all the people who live in there, self-organized, self-financed. And in that, we also have an association that offers housing for elderly people, and not only for elderly, but also for people with handicap. So I could offer some experience of coming off from the first ideas, what people with handicap or people in elderhood might need, how to integrate them into a larger housing project. Inclusion is a big issue, and how you say, self-sustained living till old age are important issues. And I think that is why I was very, very glad to support SOA on investigating further in this subject.
Yeah. I mean, one question I have for both of you, actually, which you both touched on in maybe different ways, is this form of practice. And by that, I mean, you use the word cooperative or collective, Inka, where, you know, these self-organized groups are making this kind of work, which is different than an investment-led or an investment-directed, let's say, commercial construction. Other than your conversation, you talked about this practice, people saying to you sometimes they didn't even realize you're an architect, because you're clearly not out there making, you know, architecture in the way that we might traditionally understood to be the product of it. And Porig from SOA talks quite a lot about this, the work that they're doing in terms of trying to build this culture of self-organized or housing cooperatives, and it being quite nascent in Ireland, and actually having to shift the culture and shift attitudes and shift mindsets, as much as just provide the tools or the policies or whatever. I'm just curious, Inka, and this may be a massive question, from your observations or knowledge of the area, what are the key things that have built or driven or supported that culture in Germany or in Berlin? Because sometimes it's useful to know those because they are the things that might need to be recreated or at least recreated in a specific Irish context or in the context of Cork.
That's very interesting because we're just discussing it now. We are facing a new major crisis in building. Like we have housing shortage in Berlin coming up at the moment, which is also increased by the refugees. We have rising building costs. We have rising interest rates. That interesting enough, after we had a boom where, you know, interest rates were so low and to build real estate with a good return of investment was very easy for investors. So they were buying the whole market of land and building there, and was harder and harder for projects like ours, which are self-organized, to get a feet on the ground. But I call it the booming phase. Would that be an appropriate expression? The booming phase of the self-organized housing scene in Berlin or maybe all over Germany was actually one like that, where it was not attractive for real estate developers to do something, because you need to have a relation between building costs, land costs of land, building costs, and then the price to which you can sell it. And the price or rent it, you know, each of one, they need to be in a relation that somebody who is doing it as an investment can get a good return of investment. And when now the building costs increase so much and interest rates increase very much, but people can't simply afford it anymore to pay even more for the housing, suddenly the real estate developers cannot put any more on top, you know, and then at the moment they stop building. And this is what now in our news come, you don't see German news, I don't see the Irish, but our news are full of reports of this housing project stopped, this developer is either going bankrupt or stopping all his project or delaying his project because it's just not profitable anymore. Of course, our project's a little bit concerned about that, but I'm looking at it more, okay, this is a time in which projects that don't need this extra profit on top, you know, it's hard enough to get that, but they only need to be self-affordable. So you have the costs here and you need to be able to pay for it, but you don't need to make a plus on top of it. They might become more interesting. And the time where the majority of these projects started in Berlin was exactly one of that. The rents in Berlin used to be very low. So everybody was looking, oh, you have no housing shortage, you have very low rents, but it was not attractive to people to invest. But groups got together and said, yeah, but we don't find anything appropriate for our families on the housing market. So young families, young people got together, they bought a plot together and they got an architect to build something themselves. And I like this kind of self-empowerment. Usually the people building for themselves leads them to look more into longer lasting sustainability. If an investor builds something and resells it, sustainability is not an issue. He doesn't care about the running costs. But if a group that gets together as the users themselves, they look into long-term affordability, they look into sustainability, they look into long-term running costs. So these things of, I call it kind of a bottom-up movement and empowering people, is also leading to better solutions for our planet in a way, because they build more longer-lasting solutions. And often it's also like if a group does something that's challenging together, like housing is a very, very challenging issue. You're dealing with a lot of money, housing, building, even with the best architect. I think if you have no problem on the building side, something is, it's not of this planet. It's like, you know, it's something very, so it's a huge challenge for groups to create something as complex as a building together, but in a way that it also has a strengthening effect on a community. So I think it has a very empowering, strengthening connect on the community. And of course, if they design something for themselves, they design it perfectly according to their needs. So you don't build something extra that you don't need. You build what you need, but not much more, because you wouldn't spend money on it. So it's this very user-friendly design that I'm fascinated by, and I think just something more designed in visual makes our cities more attractive. I noticed that it's so overwhelming that I'm starting to get used to it, but for the longest time I've really been suffering from cities going into this very uniform fuse. You know, you have a certain kind, this very economically sufficient architecture has a standard outlook, and the standardization, instead of something personal, has a coolness to it that I personally suffer from. So I like I like cities architecture to be more individually designed and to see, oh, this is a house X and it was developed by them, and this is a house Y and it was developed by that group. And it shows somehow the different characteristics of the people in there, the different ideas of the people who designed it together with the architect. And the city becomes more personal and more interesting. And I think it also does something with our mental health. I think if we have more variety and we can see something that expressing more the user's needs, somehow it triggers our brain differently than if you have everything completely unified standard. So I think it has something to do with resilience for our society on so many levels that I cannot explain them all, especially not with my poor English. But I think the self-organized architecture, and to have at least some key points in there, you know, like some landmarks. We will never be the ones to cover the whole city, but at least to have some landmarks to show that a different way of architecture, style, and city planning is possible is important for the society as a whole. That's my conviction.
Yeah, and it's very beautifully articulated. I think it's very passionate. I would personally agree, but maybe to connect the two points a little bit. I mean, when you talk about collective endeavor or collective empowerment through mm-hmm. sort of collective action, mm-hmm. and then you talk about the benefits of that to someone's health, or also to their sense of I'm going to translate a little bit, sense of ownership or agency mm-hmm. over the thing they mm-hmm. make, which means they make it efficiently, but they also make it for life because they're mm-hmm. going to do it once. I'm curious about then to kind of project that back to the project in Cork a little bit and understand mm-hmm. how the group in Cork got together and how they formed, because in a way they didn't all decide to make a housing project together, or it didn't emerge. You had to kind mm-hmm. of lasso people mm-hmm. together, Alva, and then you had to sort of gather their collective potential and translate it into something. So maybe could you start, tell us a little bit about how you worked or how you set up workshops and how you the process started with them?
Very much through an open call to a community of interest. So while in the other two projects, I think it was very much an open call to everyone in the community, I very deliberately picked a community group of interest and started and focused with them, not isolating musicians in this idolized way that they're a special type of person, but genuinely that they're, you know, they're a community of people working in a very particular way and living in a very particular way. So the open call went out through the record shop to the community, who engage with the record shop on a weekly, a monthly, a yearly basis. And anybody who showed interest in the topic, I suppose an initial briefing, 2-page document with some questions, some context, and how I felt we could work together. Anyone who showed interest in that came to just an information evening. So again, hosted in the cafe, in the record shop, in a really familiar place for a lot of those people to gather already. But what was fascinating is in that first meeting, we had people all around the table who all frequent the same record shop or cafe, but who didn't know each other. So straight away, there was quite an interesting mix of independent music makers or supporters, producers, sound engineers, all coming together to talk about this topic. At each point in the workshops, I suppose, after that initial meeting and deciding who was interested in coming on board, we really designed the workshops together. So our first encounter, you could say once people had opted in to the workshops, was to design a walking route around the city. Again, around streets we were all very familiar with, but to map out in isolation, so sitting in the record shop, in the cafe, point out on the map places where we had paused before, places where we thought something was working, places where we thought it wasn't. And once we had that route mapped out, we then discussed who might like to perform, play music, activate the streetscape at different points along the walking tour route so that we could comfortably stop and pause, think, take note, and really experience how the city was working, very much in situ, embed ourselves in the place. So taking that abstract conversation from the first week, we then moved into a series of workshops and walking tours where we went and listened to improvised performance. We tested the city. We tested the ideas that we had discussed. And one really funny example, which really stood with us as a group, was sitting on this kind of stone bench, timber clad, with handrails on it, a conversation emerged about this anti-skateboarder condition that was found on the bench. But I, having very, I suppose, unfairly done my homework maybe a couple of days beforehand, knew that it was actually an age-friendly intervention. The handrails on the side of the bench were there to help an elderly person sitting down. So immediately, just showing, and through being able to kind of congregate held by music, we were able to stay long enough to tease out some of these discussions and to make visible the complexities of something as simple as a bench, which I know goes without saying is actually quite complex and contested. Then that allowed us in a later week to go on a slightly extended walking tour with the city architect, so one of the city architect's department's team, and visit a housing project that is being currently under construction, and to explore some of the topics that we again were discussing in abstraction, kind of scenario building, playing out ideas for the future to actually apply them to something that was being built in the present. At another moment, following a visit to the city archives, so then kind of jumping back in history, looking at the corporation buildings and one very unique set of duplex terraced row apartments and a housing complex built by the corporation for people working in the city to live in the city. So these buildings present day are still occupied, but they face a huge, I suppose, issue at the moment that they're, you know, they're brick buildings, their U values very poorly performing, but they are still providing housing for people within the city. So again, pausing, activating the streetscape around those houses and seeing actually that by playing music in what is often a completely overlooked laneway, we found we had people, passers-by, stopping to listen to music. Some of the residents came out and engaged in conversation, asked us what we were up to. I suppose it just by introducing the music and the musical performance, essentially busking, but with an audience, you know, you're bringing your own audience, allowing ourselves to see what emerged within the streetscape. And one thing as well, maybe just one final note on the music, because it was incredibly rich, the results that even the musicians performing themselves on each walking tour. So there was one musician performed on each walking tour, but they played in three or four different places. And moving a short 20 meters from one place to another, the musicians themselves said, "I actually felt welcome to perform here. I felt like I was trespassing, performing on another piece of street." So everything in the public realm, very, very giving or presenting very varying conditions. So again, maybe back to Inka's point about, you know, variation in what we add to the built environment. It's so important that we provide variety and a variety of spaces, a variety of conditions. So a variety of activities, a variety of preferences can be met within the city.
One of the things I'm curious always about in these kinds of projects, when people realize they're talking about architecture, maybe to phrase it another way, did you feel that people initially were unable to or unwilling to or reluctant to think they had something to say? I know this happened in one of the other groups where there was people saying, "Well, I don't have anything to say about that."
I could try and answer it maybe with a few different examples. But in one instance, somebody, their solution to the scenario of aging was to introduce better bus routes so that they could more efficiently bus themselves in and out of the city to perform for the public. But then we took examples like that and we'd flip them on their head and we'd say, "Well, what if you live where the venue is and the audience comes to you and the audience happens to be your neighbors? You know, how does that feel?" So it was trying. I think I was very lucky that the group I was working with, given the nature of the process driven ways in which they work, they were really open to trying to think of things in a different way. They were very open to flipping things on their head. So that example of, "Well, I live in the countryside, I just need the bus route to be more reliable," they were really open and very quickly able to flip that to, "Well, actually, if I lived in the city, here's what I'd need." And one thing that we used to identify, I suppose, architectural priorities in elderhood and housing was a wheel of priorities. So in one of the earlier workshops, I invited everyone to individually sit and reflect on their top 10 priorities now and in elderhood. So one is factually right now, what do I need? And the other is what do I think I will need? Then we regrouped, we categorized them, we prioritized them as a group. Again, once we had kind of a long list, everyone voted again. It was really interesting to see that some people commented, what I thought I needed, I no longer think I need. And this was all in the space of a really short 40, 50 minute session. And by the end of that, we had a collective idea of what the priorities for physical built intervention would entail. Some of them were very specific, but some of them, again, were so, you know, they were so akin to anything anybody would want in housing or would want in elderhood in a civic scenario. You know, what is it to live in a healthy city? What is it to live in an accessible city, a resilient city? They just wanted public outdoor space where they felt safe, where they felt welcome. They wanted private, public, semi-public outdoor spaces. They wanted a community space, but a space that could be flexible. So it could be adapted to host the musician rehearsing on one day, performing the next, just meeting to read a book on the third. They wanted privacy, they wanted stability, a huge piece, as is the case in any community you look at right now. Back to Inka's comment about Berlin, people just want stability. They want stability of tenure, stability of habitation, that level of sustainability, quality over time, that there's a durational quality that's needed, not just the first day you turn the key in the door and walk into your home. You want to know that stability quality, that will remain 10, 20, 30 years down the line. And then back to that idea of community, that the young can help the old can help the young, but what is it that needs to be built? What's the network of community that needs to be built around that for something like that to be sustained or sustainable? Because with so many of these projects or so many of these ideas, when they emerge, they're described as aspirational. But in reality, how would that play out? And I think that's something that, again, back to the record shop, drew me there day one. It's something that in your kind of typical business plan, you know, oh, it's just not sustainable. It shouldn't work. But it does sustain itself because it has built such a strong community around it.
Mm-hmm. And kind of network of community that you describe, in your experience, Inka, then how does design play a role in that, or the physical organization of the housing collective? Mm-hmm. Because we often think, let's say, an architecture school, or we're kind of trained somehow to think that if we design, we can design community like entirely, you know, we can make it all mm-hmm. work in a building. And of course, we know then to our heartbreak in reality, and also from our own lived experience, that doesn't happen. There's so many other influences that enable or disable us to interact. But design of good housing, and as you've talked about it, stable, mm-hmm. flexible, open, personal housing, mm-hmm. surely must mm-hmm. have a role in making this mm-hmm. network of mm-hmm. community.
I first would like to add something to what Albert just said, because when I talked about this approach of, I think user-friendly is not the right translation, but user needs adapted design, or design that's adapted to user needs. The first question is, how do I learn about the user needs? You know, it's just like, I think it's also answering a bit your questions. If I think I come from a design school and so know the user needs, and it's completely different than as a first approach going in there and listen and try to be as open as possible to learn as much and understand as much from that. And then even if you try to do these research questions, how does your research reach the people that it's meant to reach? And in that way, I want to just express my great adoration for the work that Albi does, because I think people who haven't done this before cannot esteem how much work really goes into that, reaching out as far as she does to really reach the people. And something that appears so low key is just the way to get the greatest accessibility, to reach out to people, to make it approachable and connect, you know, to connect your research to the people that's meant to. We often have this, if you design a joint owners building groups, often only people from a certain intellectual standing apply and get together in these groups. If you go out and designing a city, I was involved in groups in Berlin who were thinking like, how can we design city quarters with that same approach? But how do we reach everybody? You know, some people would go into Zoom and internet and contact us here, but not everybody goes to a meeting. Not everybody reads a paper on this. Not everybody reads a document. But if you do something like Albi does, you go out in the street, you start with music, you sit on a bench, you start very low-key, is one of the best ways to kind of make sure that you research what are the needs of the people, reaches everybody. And that is so much more work than it seems like. So great respect for your work here. And now you need to go back to your question. I hope I didn't lose it. How does it come into design? I think there's something else that happens almost in a magic way. And something else I felt when I was co-working with Albi on this. It's like when you start discussing a topic, so much more happens than just like, oh, you get this information from there. I have a feeling when you're discussing a topic with the people who have said needs or with a partner who is kind of working on the same subject, it's like you're opening up a space for creativity where you dissolve variation A and there's a solving for the problem B, but then C, D, E, and F come up because you just open up a creative space in which things can come up, and they don't come from the design school, they don't come from the book, they come out of the situation where you think about, oh, maybe we could do it this way, and oh, is this, yeah, but if you know, a little bit adaption to that and this, and then from that adaption comes the third, and then you say, that's it. And this is why I love so much to design housing together with the former users, because of course, we can design a house too, where we apply all our knowledge and the experience that we have from talking to so many people in other projects. But to really build it according to the people who live there, every group is a little different. Every person is a little bit different in their needs. And only if we talk to them, we can really do a design that's completely adapted to their needs. And it's listening, talking, bringing in ideas, adapting, and yeah. Maybe, I don't know if that answers your question well enough.
Well, maybe just to add to Inka's points there, I think a big misconception with community-led often is that community-led means community-shared. And I think that it's really interesting to hear early on that a group's priorities can be to have private, you know, solitude is my key. That's my priority. That's everyone's priority. We don't want to share things. We don't want to co-own. We don't need to coexist. But we are a community, and we will be a community who hold things for ourselves. And it's actually beginning to maybe break down some of those misconceptions around how communities can organize. It's not about absolute codependence, because back to Inka's example of the housing project that she has delivered in Berlin, people are being equipped with the ability, with the facilities, the amenities to live independently into elderhood. And that's something that really fascinates me, and obviously many others in Ireland at the moment. We go from independently living in a house, which is usually private owner occupier or rented, you know, from a landlord. They're the kind of the two routes we currently have, unless you're on, you know, social housing list or are lucky enough to secure one of the social houses available. But that you move from that independent living scenario right into fully supported living. There are some great examples like Macaulay Place, a few, I suppose, rather than many, beginning to emerge in the country. But what is that one? What's going to fill that gap in the middle where we would like supported or assisted living, but we remain independent? Because health-wise, come back to that, in a city or in the countryside, to be able to live independently or autonomously for as long as possible, that is truly, in my opinion, and I think shared with many others, a really healthy way to continue to live. The more that you become, familiar with being supported by others, the more you give over your agency, the more that you kind of, yeah, I suppose it's just rapid. It's making more rapid the effects that aging will have on any of us. So to be able to hold that agency in holding on to our independence for as long as possible, I think that that's huge. That's a huge advantage in considering things as a community.
I think, if I may add something, because it was the question, how does it show in design? I would like to say that in the best case, we try to offer also a flexibility. A little bit, I love to say we design as well as instead of either or. So it's not so that people don't have to choose between I want to be remote and have my privacy or I want to have community. We try to bring the two options very close together. So I think one condition that community can work, unless for very few people who can stand community all the time, I think most human beings have that wish to connect with others, but also be able to retreat and have their privacy to rest and relax. So but in most of our designs, we try to make both possible and give both a lot of value. So even if we do community-led design, privacy plays an important point for people to restore their energies, to rest, but then also to interact. And sometimes community, you know, you think about a lot of space, but that can be multifunctional, one multifunctional room that can allow a lot of users for the community. And sometimes little things like the way how you design an entrance space. Like in our design, we needed for some water issues, we needed to lift the ground for a little bit. So we have a few steps leading in the house. It's still barrier-free because the elevator can be reached from street level. So that's not a barrier, but we have three steps into the house and they are made from three very thick oak beams. So it's a warm material that you can also sit on. And it's some element that was necessary anyhow to enter the house. So it's nothing extra, but just by the choice of material, the surface is inviting and we have made it just a little bit wider. So there can be three people sitting there and a fourth one can still pass without them blocking it. And I'm always happy when I get home and I find that some people are actually using it the way I designed it. You know, whenever there's somebody sitting on those steps, I say, yeah, that's what it was meant for. They enter the house, taking out the letters from the letterbox and they start to chat and they can sit down and continue the chat and then go to their apartments. It doesn't take any extra space, you know, but it's just designed in a way to make not only one way of functioning possible, but also to allow something else.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that you're all or both touching on is this question of generosity or a kind of an abundance that isn't, you know, hugely extravagant, but either a generosity in terms of the design attention that you've given something, as you're saying, Inka, it doesn't cost more or it doesn't take more space, but it just requires you to understand how people might use space or pursue it with a group of people, a lot of listening and discussion. At the same time, I think to go back to a very early point or your kind of concern about the city and everything being driven to look the same, everything's also driven generally within a certain kind of architecture to be small and efficient and tiny and minimal. And housing, certainly in the Irish context, is being really pushed that way. And now in a time of urgency, small things or dimension is linked with speed rather as well as economy. So it's a double whammy. Mm-hmm. I think in regard to aging as well in place, surely there must be some sense that we need fat or looseness or space that is not mm-hmm. necessarily from the outset understood how it's going to be used, but can be mm-hmm. adapted, or someone can come and live there if you need care in the future, or you can mm-hmm. move to a smaller house. Could you talk a little bit about that, maybe either from your experience, Alvin, in terms of people you've spoken to, or in terms of your work, about those moments of dimensional generosity or spatial generosity where you've given, where something has happened because you've allowed more potential in the future? Because you also, no matter how much you talk to someone or how much work you put in at the start, you can never fully anticipate every outcome. Mm-hmm. So you have to build some contingency in there, spatially and materially, right?
In anything that we deem to be efficient, I think with time, it will only teach us what its inefficiencies are. So there's this perception that things are efficient, small apartment, we got it built quick. But I think something that we need to work harder at, and I say we very broadly in this sense, is linking, you know, the expense that comes later down the road in accommodating somebody in a more generous apartment that allows a wheelchair to fit in beside a bed, for instance. If we have this efficiency day one and it's time, it's quality, it's financially efficient, the inefficiency is just being backloaded down the road. We're not really considering the whole picture. And that's something that I suppose through looking at community land trusts, I'm really interested in that generationally, is something efficient? Or is it just this kind of first full stop of reaching practical completion on a building site that it's efficient, or, you know, the sale of it the first time round? I think that we're trapped in really short cycles of efficiency. and that what we deem to be generous, maybe in offering 100 units instead of 50 units, is actually very, it's lacking generosity in when you look at it in the wider picture. So I think the frames through which we are analyzing, capturing, or deciding things right now, I think that they're too fast paced, and that they need to be stretched again. So that I know that's a bit of a wider take on it, but I think it's really relevant, because whether you look at the way we provide a service, the way we provide housing, the way we provide any kind of an amenity, I think that you can look at things in a really narrow lens and tick the efficiency box. But when you widen it even the slightest bit, you realize that it's so far from mm-hmm. efficient. Mm-hmm. So Inka, I don't know if you'd like to
I would like to add, just like concerning the issue of reimagining elderhood, the subject in Berlin or Germany is that often people, if they can't be provided barrier-free living at their homes, they move from their homes to caring and nursing homes. And a place in a nursing home is so expensive. You know, like nursing is so expensive. And the approach we had for this community-oriented flat is we have small apartments where they can have their privacy. They even have a very small kitchenette and barrier-free, but just a shower. So it's one room, a kitchenette, and a barrier-free shower. So they can be, if they don't feel well, because with handicapped people or elder people, you have days that you don't feel strong and community takes energy, so you might not be able to see somebody. So they have the possibility to retreat when they don't feel. So they can have their little soups and breakfast in their own rooms. But they only need to move, like open the door, and then they go into a community space where there is a larger kitchen that they can share. And there is even a bathtub that has a lift. So it's completely barrier-free accessible. And that makes all the nursing and caring so much easier. But also they meet and they can cook together. Sometimes if you have people with handicaps, one has an electric wheelchair and he can go out to the shopping, or she, because the wheelchair takes them farther. The other one has an easier way of cutting the veggies when they get home. So it's like a little bit, if you have one right hand and one left hand together, they are two hands, you know. And our idea of this community base was to create an environment, people with handicaps to help themselves, to be independent. So it's like if somebody falls out of their wheelchair at night and can't reach the telephone to call for help, they can scream for help and there's somebody around to hear them. If they would be in a home by themselves, nobody would hear them. And this is kind of just giving examples to what Albie already said, like what is efficiency? Is efficiency to have something that is only for one season? If you're not able to live in there, your old home anymore, you move to a nursing home and then everything is taken care of, which is actually much more extensive than if people live together in group, kind of helping each other. And in that way, also having a lot more dignity. I find our people develop so much dignity in the ways they design their own lives, and they find it more dignity in helping each other than in being helped by. So we do also bring in some assistance to see how much they need, but just as much as they need, not more. I had another point about efficiency. It's called Collegium Academicus, actually student housing, but it was designed by the students themselves. And there they had rooms for the students with 14 square meters. But the students themselves gave an option, so they could choose if they want to have 14 square meters or only 7. And if they would choose a room with only 7 square meters, the other 7 square meters were given to a community space, like a community living room or community kitchen for all of them. And the students each could that's strange for student housing because it's so short, but then different apartments were designed according to the students' needs. And some of them had larger rooms and some just 7 square meter, and the rest was given to a community space.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant example. But I think in modern or contemporary contexts, one thing in that example where we pinch a little more, when that pinching is for private profit, I think it becomes quite problematic. But when mm-hmm. that, for instance, is communally beneficial for a community, and the mm-hmm. word community in itself, I think, is always contentious. What is the community? Who is the community? But let's take an apartment block. The residents of the apartment block are the community. If they take that efficiency and make it beneficial for themselves, it's contained within the community, then I think that's a hugely positive asset and resource use. But when it is then extracted for profit, it becomes problematic. And back to that idea, Emmett, earlier you were asking about, you know, the systems that exist maybe in Berlin that don't exist here, for people to come together and finance projects, for people to come together and bid on land or bid on a structure, a fully completed building, partially completed, whatever it is, it's next to impossible because the financial models, the legal models, they don't really exist. There's something that needs piloting, the same way that that idea of choosing your routes of efficiency to gain that generosity. There's something that I feel really needs to be tested. We need to, I suppose, not shy away from the fear of failure. I think it won't be perfect. It can't be perfect. But we need to begin to pilot alternatives, because the way things are being carried out right now is proving itself not to be perfect. So it surely leaves scope for experimentation within, you know, acceptable boundaries.
Yeah,
I would like to add to Elba. Mm-hmm. About this financing models. It was not really subject of Reimagine Elderhood, but of course we were also going on, like, if all this research is done, how to implement it, how could it really become, you know, how could we materialize all the ideas to start to create housing that could be approachable for several generations, and for especially the elder generation. I think there's really models of solidarity economy. Yes, thank you so much. So there's models of solidarity economy that have been examined in many other European countries, and especially cooperatives that they exist. We were talking about, I think, in the rural act of agrar industry, cooperatives have been established in Ireland, but cooperatives in Germany, Austria, and many other countries are the models of how solidarity economy can be applied to create housing that then, in the long run, you know, the interesting part is that even if something now is, as I said, is just built cost covering, and it might still be expensive because you need to take quite high rent to cover the costs of building. But if it's built today cost covering, and the rental and the other housing market goes up, but you stay here because it has been built cost covering, what you are building cost covering today becomes affordable housing of the future. And most of the cooperatives in Germany are holding their buildings for a long time. Some are 200 years old. So the cooperatives, those who built that 200 years ago, they were cost covering then. And for them, it was not cheap to build then. It was in accordance to the general living standards. They were building for the same price as most other people. But what was cost covering then, today, is like a really low rent. And they can offer that to all the cooperative members. And then on top, often because they have a generation contract, once they make profit because they can raise the rent a little bit in order to, they don't need all that rent anymore to cost cover, they build up a little reserve. And if they use that reserve to buy new land to later then be able to build for the next generation, some of these cooperatives have also continued to grow and now have quite a nice stock of buildings. And for many generations, they have oversupply of affordable housing to their members. So I'm in a team of young cooperatives who start now and hope one day, 200 years ago, people will look back and say, oh, they started then and then it seems so expensive, but now it's really affordable. But so we have these large grown cooperatives. Some of them have thousands of members by now. And the young ones start with 14, sometimes 15 members, and they grow to 60 and slowly, slowly grow. Mm. But it's once you start with an example and that works, and usually, you know, to cover all the bank loans, the hardest part is the beginning, the first 5-10 years. Then slowly, slowly, there starts a gap. Normally, if we don't have a very big deflation, but at the moment we have a very high inflation, though that will even happen faster, where the housing market, the rental market goes higher up, but you stay here and what you created is very affordable.
I mean, that's a perfect kind of segue, as they say, into my kind of maybe final question to you both, because we could talk about this is really a fascinating conversation. Is this relationship you have and the discussions you've been having. I observe, I've only just met you both now, I observe a very easy and comfortable and fluid conversation between you, even across Zoom, which is testifies, I think, to this exchange you've probably had. I'd love to know how it benefited your individual positions and practice, because mentoring is about experience and transfer, but it also works both ways. And obviously you work in different contexts at different stages, at different situations. So do you want to say something about the mentor process?
I was extremely grateful and extremely lucky in the mentorship that I have received from Inke. I visited Inke in Berlin, and I think, you know, aside from today, this being on Zoom, meeting in person and having a mentor who actually held a very safe space for me to grow and strengthen ideas was incredibly supportive. It was incredibly useful. It was incredibly beneficial in actually just trusting in a process that it a lot of times is very fickle, it's very uncertain. And having somebody with the knowledge, the expertise, and the lived experience, the professional experience of Inke, having someone like that to actually say, just keep going, stay on that train of thought, push it a little bit further. No, go back to it now, stick with it, see where it ends up. To have somebody to actually sit by my side and support that was just invaluable. I think that somehow creating sustained opportunities for mentorship and exchange, because as you point out, mentor-mentee, it's a two-way road. So having opportunities like that built into practice, I think is completely invaluable. The same way I believe research and practice, they're not two separate things. They should live together. I think mentorship should be something that we all aspire to receive and to give continuously through architectural practice.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure for me to work with Albert and very inspiring too. And even so, I mean, if Albi talks about it, might all sound so easy to be done. There's a reason why what we do is not mainstream. I think the way to do this kind of approach of architecture needs a lot of idealism. And as I say, it's not mainstream. You have to overcome, if you do a pioneer project, you know, you have often to also overcome. It's not there yet. It is going really gonna work. And by talking about it, it's like this encouragement, I think, and that was vice versa. So if, as I said, like talking with Albi about the issues, it creates a space in which like ideas get more sharpened in clarity. So discussing what's really important, trying to see what is the important, why is it important? You know, why is it important that you go out in the street and apply the thing of music, and why is it a good start, and where does it lead to? And it was extremely inspiring and in a way also sharpening for me, you know, what is the important part of our work, how can it be done, what is it all about, and what is it for. So I'm very thankful for the space that was creating by the two of us to meet and connect, and I hope we will stay in touch beyond this mentorship program.
You can find out a lot more about this project by visiting soa.ie, and from the 7th to the 15th of October, there is an exhibition of the Reimagining Elderhood project at 2 Curve Street, Temple Bar in Dublin, which is running as part of Open House Dublin. But of course, if you're listening to the podcast after those dates, well, you'd have to stick to the website. What Buildings Do is supported by the Irish Architecture Foundation as part of our efforts to advance the culture of architecture in Ireland. Thank you for listening. The music is by Sinead Finnegan, and all design work is by Eamon Hall. Until next time, take care.